These are the true stories of farmers, conservationists, sustainable ag advocates, and researchers dedicated to advancing public policies to achieve a sustainable farming and food system in the United States. Find out what happens when people take action and start caring for the land.
This is Ron Cruz. Today, videographer Kyle Grinberg and I are in the meeting room at the Eden Prairie, Minnesota Public Library, where I have the honor of interviewing Bob Berglund, who served as Secretary of Agriculture under President Jimmy Carter from 1977 to 1981. Of course, there's much more to Mr. Berglund's long and distinguished career. Family farmer from northwestern Minnesota, three complete terms as representative of the 7th District of Minnesota in Washington, D.C., a general manager of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, and a regent at the University of Minnesota, just to name some of the highlights. In this interview, I hope to touch on all aspects of your several decades of public service, but because it was your vision and leadership that led to the federal government's first initiatives in organic and sustainable agriculture, this will be the primary focus of what we're going to talk about this morning. That said, Bob, I've interviewed several people who played vital roles in developing and advancing sustainable policies over the last three decades, several of whom you know. And I always like to start with all of them at the beginning, going all the way back to the childhood, the boyhood. What formed their interest in agriculture and ultimately in farm policy? So let's start at the beginning. With your background.
Well, my grandparents were farming people. They were immigrants from Norway, came to America in the early 1900s. And my dad and mother were of Norwegian descent, but were born here. But they were born into mother's family was farming, and dad's family was a automobile business, mechanics. They fixed things. Dad had a mechanical inclination, and he taught me many of the mechanical skills he had. Mother was a school teacher, taught in a local country 8th grade school district, which were common in those years, one-room school, and she was a taskmaster. When I was home, she was my tutor. She took on that job, and she had flash gun cards, little cards made with numbers and letters on it, and would flash the numbers, and I was supposed to add them up, and I did, and spelling was important, not only how to spell a word, but how to use it. Grammar was important. And she drilled it into me, and kept on until I got it right. And I never forgot it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, and then, so you were helping on the farm, but eventually, because you were a good student, you decided to go to college, right? And you went to Minneapolis.
Yes, I did.
I read for the first time you went to Minneapolis. And you went to school.
That's right. I went to Minneapolis. I was in high school when the war, World War II ended, mm-hmm. and in 1944. And I graduated from high school in 1946. So I wanted to go to the University of Minnesota, and I applied and was told I couldn't get in because the GI Bill gave returning veterans preference, oh, yes. Which was fine.
Yeah.
I had no quarrel with that. And they directed me to the School of Agriculture, which was a diploma school. It was not a degree-granting program. A two-year intensive course in practical agricultural matters. So I enrolled in that, School of Agriculture, University of Minnesota. Since then, it's been merged into the college.
And I read an interview you did, and I want to draw attention to it for the purposes of the archive. It's at the University of Minnesota. Easily found by associate dean Ann Plum that did an interview with you in 1999 that covers a lot of the details in a colorful way of your upbringing and your early years. But one of the things too you noted in there that I thought was very interesting that when your dad was a farm laborite.
Yes.
Some of your early thinking in politics and your democratic leanings from your father.
Yeah, I was born that way. I came by it honestly.
Yeah.
Both mother and dad's family, they weren't hard left-wing farm labor rights. They weren't out in the socialist ranks, but they were to the left of center, mm-hmm. progressive in their views. They supported FDR and all of the New Deal. They thought it was the second coming. And so kind of a mainstream Democratic upbringing. And I've stayed that way.
Right. And I don't know if they were able to still be around and physically to be alive at the time. But when I think about your years at the Rural Electrification Co-op, I remember my own parents and grandparents, how important that was, in my case in northwestern Iowa, a very strong New Deal program.
That's right.
And then you got to direct that for 10 years. We'll get at that later. But okay. It's interesting that this all kind of set very early on.
Early on, that's right. It's all part of the same generation of activity.
Right. And the other thing that Plum interview pointed out, too, was even back in, even though you were kind of a greenhorn coming into the city, back then you were even interested in Hubert Humphrey and his 48 campaign.
I was, and that came through my mother and dad. Uh-huh. They maintained their activity in the Democratic Party up home in the local county organization, and mother especially was active. And so she kept my nose to the grindstone politically, and I took an interest in the Humphrey campaign when it was getting organized.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then he went on and became, in 48 or soon after, he gave that very famous civil rights speech. He was one of the first to speak out on that.
That's right.
It must have been in his first term, maybe.
I think so. He went against the grain at the time, created a great disturbance.
Right.
Because Minnesota people weren't accustomed to hearing that kind of talk.
Yeah, and the Dixiecrats were still in power, and that was sort of the beginning of the break.
That's right.
With the Democratic Party and a turn away from the Democrats and the Southern Dixiecrats.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
Well, then you went back to the farm in the 50s and were farming, and then make ends meet a little later on, you went to work with the ASCS, right? The Ag Stabilization and Conservation.
I did. I had a job with them for a while.
Right.
Yeah.
We were farming as a part time. You were farming and doing that, weren't you?
Yeah, part time. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I bought I went home in 1946. I graduated from the university, went home. And I had a soil science professor was talking to me about a new thing in farming called fertilizer.
Oh, yeah.
Brand new. And I excited my interest in it. And so when I got home, I talked to Dad, and I said, I'd like to try a thing called test plots. Mm. He didn't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. I didn't either, for that matter. But this professor, I got in touch with him. I said, we want to do a test plot on our farm, which is just 1 mile south of our town, right on the highway. And he said, I don't know how to go about this. He said, well, I'll help you. So he came up with some equipment, and we went out to the place and laid it out and laid out the plots. And then he told me what kind of fertilizers to buy. And put it and how to arrange the thing, so I did it exactly. He said I planted the whole thing to wheat because that farm was going to go into the spring wheat that year, so I just planted all of it in the wheat crop and then put in the stakes for the fertilizer, and it was nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash in the various blends and combinations. And I'd staked it and marked it, and it was parallel to the highway. And when the crop, well, I had a cranky uncle. A bachelor brother of my father, who came over watching what I was doing, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm putting down fertilizer." So he dipped his finger in the fertilizer and tasted it. It's salt. He said, "You're killing this land." He talked to my dad and he said, "You got to stop this kid. He's going to ruin everything." So Dad said, "Oh no." He said, "Where do you get these nutty ideas? Well, he's at the university." So the dad held to us, and so. The crop started growing, sprouting, and you could see those fertilizer test plots responding just like night and day. I mean, you could see it from a long ways away as the people got closer and they talked to them. What's this all about? What are you doing to that thing? Well, it's my, because I was at the university and was learning some things, and they were impressed. Mm-hmm. Carl was not. Mm-hmm. He stayed hard-boiled. He said, this is just freaky stuff. It'll never grow. It won't mature. You can't keep it. It'll be all. Imagine all the things wrong with it. But Dad said, had faith in what I was learning, and so we kept it, and we We found out what it could do. Fertilizer. That was the first experiment in the county, I think.
Really? You know, and that brings to mind another kind of hallmark that ultimately grew out of some of your work on policy is there's the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program called SARE. And the fundamental aspect of that program is on-farm research.
Yep.
The farmers doing their research and proving it to themselves and to their neighbors.
They have to do it that way. Right. You can't depend entirely on Extension Research Service. You've got to take that knowledge and spread it.
Right.
And that's what we did.
Right. And they even are learning some things that the scientists don't always know, too, which is
a lot of it by accident.
Yeah.
We don't, to this day, we sometimes don't know what happened, but we know it did.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's really good. So then you, I know you worked with the ASCS in the state for a while, and then I believe it was after Orville Freeman became Secretary of Agriculture under Kennedy, they invited you to take more of a regional position and move to Washington and work for the agriculture.
I was what they call an area director. It was for the agency was ASCS, the Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service.
Right.
And I was the director for the Midwest area states from Wisconsin to the Dakotas and in between.
And then I think that lasted several 6 years or something. I don't know, something like that. And you decided then to take in 68 as unsuccessful run for Congress.
Yeah.
But then you ran again in 70 and you won.
I ran 68.
Yeah.
We didn't have much money. The Democratic Party wasn't very well organized. And I was advised by the people, the senior members of the party, to don't get into any heavy spending plans.
Because you didn't have a lot of money either.
I didn't have any money to put into it. And I told them that very early on and said, I don't have any money to put into this. Keep that in mind. I said, all I can do is provide my time, and I'll do that willingly. But I can't pay for any expense, and I won't, and I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I kept myself free of debt, and we just spent what we could get. No television advertising.
Right.
We did local radio and some newspapers, local newspapers, and that was about it.
Yeah.
Because we just didn't have the money to do it. I think our budget the first campaign year was $13,000.
Wow.
And we paid all our bills.
Yeah.
I lost the election, but not by much. I ran against a well-established Republican, a fine man, but he was getting a little bit old for his day. And his judgment wasn't the best. And he hadn't kept up on all the modern changes taking place in agriculture. And I was.
Yeah.
People saw I knew what I was talking about.
Right.
And the fellow I run against, he just tried to dismiss it as a child's talk, you know, put me down because I was too young.
Uh-huh.
And anyhow, I didn't win, but I came close and I didn't leave any debt.
And you got name recognition.
And I got name recognition. And the understanding I had with the party leaders was if I run well enough, I want the right to choose. I want the right to decide whether I want to run again, because if I have a chance, I want to go twice.
Mm.
And they said, good with us. So that's what I did. Ran the second time around, and I beat him pretty handily.
Huh.
But by that time, I was well enough established so that other people took an interest in my campaign. And I was able, they were able to raise enough money so I could run a respectable show.
Good. So that took you to Congress.
That took me to Congress,
yeah. And you ended up serving there from 71 to 76.
I was elected four times. Served out three terms.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I resigned my fourth term. Jimmy Carter was elected president, and he asked me to join his cabinet as Secretary of Agriculture. And that idea came from Walter Mondale.
Oh, it did.
Mondale was vice president, and Mondale was my buddy
in
every respect. And he told President I'd make a good Secretary of Agriculture, and Carter took his word for it.
I bet you and Carter probably hit it off pretty well, I think.
We hit it off real well. Yeah, we did. We hit it off real well. He was an honest guy. He didn't pretend to be something he wasn't. He was a religious fellow.
Mm-hmm.
He practiced what he believed, and he was easy to talk to. He was not terribly overbearing, not terribly sophisticated, but he's honest and true, and we could believe him. You could believe his word. You could put it in the bank, and that's the way we got along. He was an environmentalist, even then, before it was fashionable. Mm-hmm. He had had experience in Georgia mm-hmm. on matters relating to the environment, and he knew that we had to deal with water, and we had to watch, we had to do something about air pollution. He understood all that, and he did not pass it off as a whim. He knew it was a very serious national problem and had to be dealt with, and instructed me to do everything I could, whatever it might be, to follow suit in the farm policy, without specifying what it should be. Just that I sort of had a blank check.
Wow, that's wonderful, and I know that that was some tough times too. I mean, during your time in Congress in the 70s, the Vietnam War was still going on. The about 74, the farm prices started going downhill after all the Butts years, and the overproduction really kind of hit the fan and the prices went down.
Yeah.
You were having to deal with all that while you were in Congress on the Ag Committee. And much of it was still going on, as I understand it, when you actually took over the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, the farm prices were falling. Yeah. You know, we inherited a mess, as they say today.
Yeah.
But it was really tough because there was huge surpluses in the United States, and the world market was not developing fast. There was a spurt after World War II,
right.
And then it kind of tapered off.
Right.
And they tapered off largely because Europe got its feet under its on itself, and it was able to grow enough to feed itself. Mm-hmm. It had been a market for enormous shipments of boatloads of grain and other foodstuffs of Europe right after the war. That all tapered away, of course, mm-hmm. as expected. And the production kept increasing. Technology changed all the time. Even then, mm-hmm. Varieties improved. Genetics improved. Genetic engineering was just getting, mm-hmm. was it kind of in its infancy. But the scientists knew that great things could happen, and they did. And I believed them. They didn't have to convince me. Mm-hmm. And so the results of those changes in technology did produce a big increase in yields, and to this day that's continued.
And then that's true, and at the same time, from what I've read and I understand from my past somewhat, some of the downsides of the use of fertilizers and pesticides and things like that were starting to show up too and during that 70s when that environmental surge came.
Yeah, there was, and they were primarily, the things they worried about were legitimate. Mm-hmm. They were worried about things we didn't know, things we were doing and didn't know why, or things that we should be doing that we didn't even know about.
Right.
And they'd prompt us and prod me and taught me a lot.
The other thing that, and we'll get to this, a real important thing, like I'm going to cover, if we may, like four things that happened during your tenure that had a long-lasting effect on policy going forward. And one of them had to deal with the structure of agriculture, because while there was good things happening in production, almost miraculous levels of increase of production, there was also a decline happening in the number of farms, and particularly that mid-sized family farm.
And it's going on to this day.
Yes.
It's still happening.
Great.
And yes, I took a keen interest in that. The Homestead Act of 1856 created the basis for the iconic American family farm. Mm-hmm. That law was federal and applied to all the lands that were within the jurisdiction of the United States. It did not affect the Indian reservations and land set aside for parks and the forests and that kind of thing.
Right.
Everything else was eligible for homestead, but the law said only 160 acres per family. That's all. No giant farms under that law. 160 acres, and you didn't have to pay for that. All you had to do was live on it. Mm-hmm. What they call proving up. Mm-hmm. That meant going there and building a house, establishing a family, mm-hmm. and clearing the land and doing whatever it had to be done. And they of course it was very primitive. You know, farmed a lot of it with oxen and horses and human power, and did whatever they could. But eventually, you know, overcame it, got it going, and started. And then World War One came along, and by that time things were improving rather drastically in the farming technology field.
Right.
And yields were up, fertilizers were becoming available, pesticides were developed to control weeds and insects. That all happened around the World War II time. And so after the war ended, all that stuff started to bloom.
Mm-hmm. And during your tenure there, you were dealing with some of those, or at least even in Congress, with what reforms are needed to be made around some of that early legislation, like that, as I understand it.
Well, we did, and we had big fights over payment limits, for example. Mm-hmm. I maintained the policy we were going to restrict payments. We wanted to be true to the principles of the Homestead Act, 160-acre, diversified, family-owned and operated farming. That was the basis of all our developed studies and development on agricultural policy. I came under heavy fire on that one because people said I should let them go, get them begged, do what they want. It's their land, it's their choice, and I resisted it.
Right.
I got in trouble for it, but I did, and I stuck by my guns.
I know that you had some arguments with the American agriculture movement, with at that time the tractor caves were happening. I mean, you can't underestimate the desperation people were feeling. A lot of people got, and as they say now, underwater, but really over their heads.
Way over their head.
Yeah.
And they got talked into the dumbest decisions they could ever imagine.
Right.
Bought land they couldn't afford. Paid more money than they could afford, bought equipment on credit, no money down, easy payments. Mm-hmm. They couldn't meet the obligations. And the ones that the traditional family farm that had stayed true to its original intent, diversified, small scale, livestock and of all kinds and crops to go with it, and no heavy debt, they survived.
Right.
But those high flyers didn't.
Right.
They went under early on, and it came to me were begging help, and I said, no, I'm not going to help you guys. You made this mess, and you're going to have to work your way out of it. I flatly refused to put in federal money to bail them out of a bad choice, and I stood by my guns, and they stormed the Capitol, they stormed the White House. I was forced to leave the White House, forced to leave the department one day. Police came and said, you got to get out of here. These people have surrounded the building and they're carrying shotguns and we don't know what's going to happen, but you can't take a chance. So they escorted me out of the department through a basement, a corridor I didn't even know existed.
Wow.
Got me into the White House and I was there for 4 days.
I've never heard that story before. That's very interesting. I did read one place when he gave a talk, I think in Amarillo, Texas, where they were throwing eggs at you.
Oh, yeah. I had a lot of that. Yeah, I was not very popular. I'd go to a lot of places where I had the local police would have to escort me.
Right.
Because they said they didn't know that for sure that anything would happen, but it might because there was young people mainly, debt-ridden, not very experienced, frustrated, and didn't know what to do except rebel.
Yeah.
So they did.
You have to, I would think, put some of that on the previous administration with Earl Butz telling people to farm fence row to fence row.
That's right.
These prices are going to last forever.
Yeah, he made promises that he couldn't possibly be kept.
Right.
But he wasn't honest with people.
Yeah. So that's all that you inherited. And I think one of the seminal reports that came out of this, I want to talk a little bit about it, is this A Time to Choose, a summer report on the structure of agriculture. And that came at when you were saying that there had been a lot of goings on around all through the 70s decade in tweaking with the farm program, but it never got down to the depth of really examining what kind of structure do we need going forward to have a sound food and agriculture system.
There was a lot of resistance to that structure study.
Yes.
I was urged by a lot of the Democratic leaders in the Congress, don't do this. Let those big guys go and let them do their thing. Don't get in their way because they can make big trouble for you. And I said, well, I've had trouble before and I wouldn't yield to them. And so we got into a real scrap.
Mm-hmm.
And I stood my ground in support of the doctrine that we had been established, and I stayed with it.
I know I read that, that basically it talked about some real reforms. I'll just touch on a couple of them. Efforts are needed to reform policies to slow the march towards fewer farms and more super farms, basically discourage what was called, I think you wrote it, economic cannibalism.
Yep.
with this continuous concentration yep. happening on in agriculture. Modifications are needed to help small and medium-sized farmers recognizing the growing demands and concerns of consumers, and recognizing some of the dangers of the consolidation of the food industry and the ag input suppliers.
It's all true.
Yep.
And those are all targets of mine.
Yes.
I got blamed for them, and what I did was claim credit.
Good. Well, I know that it came out just in the waning days of the Carter administration, right? And then what happened with that? Not too much, maybe, after Reagan came in, or what happened with that report?
It was ignored.
It was.
Yeah. They just buried it.
Huh.
Stop printing it.
That's what I'd heard.
Yeah. They yeah. stopped printing, wouldn't carry it in their libraries anymore.
Yeah, right. I have in my my little briefcase over here a copy of that report and read that.
Do you?
Read through it.
Yeah.
You can get it online. You have to do a little digging.
Yeah.
It kind of got resurrected by somebody. You can get the whole report online.
Yeah,
so.
I remember that.
So
I didn't know it was online, but I remember that report
yeah.
and all the trouble it made.
Yes.
I, especially from the Southerners.
Yeah.
Huh. Southern Democrats had a lot of power.
Yeah.
And they knew how to use it, and they really bore down on me hard.
Yeah.
And I had Carter stood by me. He didn't rebel.
Yeah. That was something coming from Georgia. For
yeah, that's right. He yeah. stood by me, and I told him what I was doing. I didn't surprise him any, and he encouraged me. He kept him apprised of it, and I said, this is going to make trouble for you. And he said, well, that's nothing new.
Yeah.
He didn't. He just shrugged it off.
Huh.
Stick by your guns.
Yeah.
So I did.
Yes. The other thing that was going on at this time, too, was we'd just come off the Arab oil boycott and the whole OPEC controlling the prices of oil and everything. And one of the big concerns was all the energy consumption in the country as a whole and in agriculture, too. I know that was part of the picture at that time.
That's right. That's right. We had to examine. Carter directed that we examine everything that went on to see if there's anything we could do to reduce our dependency on oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started, you know, on a kind of locally, one-on-one to see what we could find. And we were searching. We didn't get much accomplished because we couldn't find anything big enough to make any national difference. But it came later.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good segue, I think, to this other report that I want to talk about in particular. Well, there was actually two other ones to draw on briefly. I'll mention, I think it makes sense. One of them was to point out that in 1977, there was a national resources inventory. And as far as I can read, that was really the first time there was a really deep consolidated look, maybe since the Depression years, that showed the degree of soil erosion and damage being done to the land by this big plow out that happened during the 60s and that sort of thing. And so that was another thing to have to contend with.
That's right. That really was that was an eye-opener for everybody, including me.
Huh.
I hadn't realized that it had gotten so serious. So with that, I changed my plans and my outlook and attitudes and took a much more serious interest in soil control and soil erosion, soil management.
Yeah, there was statistics that when they were dealt, you know, extrapolated, came out things like 2 bushels of soil for every bushel of corn in Iowa, things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Wendell Berry pointed that out in that book.
Yeah.
The Unsettling of America, which
yeah.
is such an important book to me. And
we really countered that one largely through the Extension Service.
Mm-hmm.
County agents scattered all over the United States were our sentinels out there. Sentinel.
Yes.
And we said, we don't know really where to start a national policy, but we want you to start looking locally. What can be done to deal with the soil erosion and all the things that were mentioned in this report, cleaning up water supplies? What can be done locally to start so we can get some idea of what this is going to cost and how to go about it? So they did. We had a county agent starting local experiment stations on a local basis, not federally supported or sanctioned. just done on what by what they could do with what they had. And we put together a lot of useful information on what could work and what didn't. And that was the basis for what became a kind of an environmental action report federally.
And another one that that came in sort of on the almost the same topic was in 89, there was the national, in 79, there was a national ag land study. And that one was done with, I think, the support of maybe some support from the government. I'm not sure, but it revealed that 1 million acres of farmland were being lost every year to development uses.
That's right.
It was being used, but it was being converted away from agriculture and in a way that usually couldn't come back.
That's right. That was a devastating report. We all knew it was happening, but didn't realize how extensive it had become.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of an alarm bell.
Yeah, I bet it was. I knew it got a lot of attention. So that all leads to this last thing I really wanted to cover in depth if we can. And that was the what became known as the Report and Recommendations on Organic Farming. It was a relatively small report, certainly didn't require much budget or anything, but really it's considered a seminal report when we're looking at the development of what has become a growing movement in sustainable and organic agriculture. And it's, the purpose of the report is it's stated in a brief note at the beginning by Anson Bertrand.
Yep.
He was the person at the ARS that I think you worked with, Science and Education,
right,
to kind of coordinate that report.
Right.
And the purpose was to learn more about the potential contribution of organic farming as a system for the production of food and fiber. Another way of looking at what are we going to do about this situation. So why did it was launched in 79, this study. Ultimately, Garth Youngberg and all the folks involved, James Parr and others, were all went around the country and interviewed 69 different farms, went on the farms, looked at them, how they were doing organic farming to get a real picture of it. I think I kind of know, but talk a little bit why you commissioned the report. There's a good story about your neighbor who is an organic farmer. Wanted you to touch on that. Do you recall that story?
I'm not sure. Can you remind me?
I'll mention his name to you. I think it was Bill. Just a second here. You had a neighbor who was a 1,500 acre or organic farm, something like Bill Bertrand or Bill something.
Yeah. Okay. I know who it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I gotcha.
And you were that. Some of this lore around this whole report is that was one of the things that spurred you to take a look at this.
Right. He was a genius in his own way, kind of a low level, not very flamboyant fellow, but tried things and did things that produced results, and he kept good track of it.
Uh-huh.
And so that was the basis for my interest in the whole thing. I could see that we could do things on a local scale without much investment if we took care of it properly. And that's how it started.
Yeah, he'd been an organic farmer for 6 years or something, I read.
Well,
a lot of people, as we've been saying, were in debt and having trouble. His operation, this mixed organic operation, was going along all right as far as.
Yeah, going all right. No, he didn't fall for the trap of getting big into machinery and growing wheat and corn and soybeans for export at prices below the cost of production. He stayed away from that.
Right. So Dr. Bertrand pulled together a bunch of people that they went around and did these visits on farms. A couple people even went to Japan to look at some organic. That's all covered in this report and recommendations. And it also provided the first official definition of what organic farming really was, which is important because there was a lot of misunderstanding and mythology around that whole notion of organic. And just like a lot of things that you've been talking about, it was pretty much dismissed by a lot of people, the whole notion that organic could even have an important role in there.
Yeah, there were big chunks of the government wouldn't even acknowledge that the problem existed.
Right.
The Republican Party fought it tooth and nail.
Yeah.
They wanted no part of it because they saw that if the organic thing could ever take root, the importance of some of the fertilizer and some of the insecticide people and other folks who had an interest in the way things were going would never agree to it.
Right.
And so they got the Republican Party to oppose it, and we fought that one all the way, but we didn't make much headway.
That was released, I think, just about 4 months before the end of your term. And there's some interesting stories out there about the fact that they were going to actually suppress or burn, apparently even burn the reports.
Yeah, they were determined to stomp it out.
Yeah, right. And one of the things that Roger Blobaum talks about, who is an organic activist, and I'm sure he lobbied you over time.
He was one of my confidential advisors.
Yeah. Oh, was he? Yeah. Yep. He's been a stalwart advocate for organic farming ever since. And he and a guy named Bob Scowcroft from California, they have these stories about how they grabbed these as many of these copies of the report as they could and kind of smuggled them out and spent the next several years basically, you know, letting people know about this report and sending it to them when they had copies. And it got a lot of press. And Garth Youngberg talks about how even though it was disliked by the Reagan administration, which had come in right after the report came out, it was very popular among people who were curious about it and interested. And it was even translated within 2 years. It was translated to 7 different languages.
Is that right? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it really had an extensive influence, despite the reaction it had to it. So it's one of those things that people really cite as sort of the kind of the father of the organic policy effort. And so nothing too much happened for a while, but with that report, folks like Senator Leahy, Jim Weaver from Oregon, ears perked up, and they had some constituents that were interested in some of these issues.
Yep.
And this gradually built up over the years, as you know, into the Organic Food Production Act, the Sustainable Ag and Research and Education Act. All of these things eventually have been growing out and still are from that original report.
And the current debate over renewable fuels is part of that.
Yes.
That grew out of it.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have been so totally dependent on petroleum and natural gas that we have come to believe that that's an infinite resource.
Yes.
Which is not, of course.
Right.
And we've come to learn how much damage is done to the air and the environment. And so the argument for our alternative for renewable fuels is very compelling and very strong. Mm-hmm. And it's a part of the same debate here that we had back then. Mm-hmm. And the opposition is about the same from right. The same sources. And they're well financed and they're determined to stomp us out.
That's one thing that reminded me of what you said in both this report on the organics and also especially even on the Time to Choose the Structure report is when I read through it, the lengthy report of Time to Choose and how it's just painfully how accurately true it is still today.
Yep.
Some of these same issues that I think that's the number one thing of these interviews I've been doing that most people say when I ask them, well, what's your biggest regret or what really hasn't happened is these fundamental structural reforms that haven't happened. Like, and so these trends of diminishing number of farms and consolidation have continued to this day.
Yeah, something is going to happen on that frontier.
Hmm.
It's going to collapse. It can't be sustained. The power that the big farms have over the small farms is enormous. And the small farms have no chance. The big farms are just so powerful that they can absorb them, and it's happening as we speak. The small towns are changing because the small farmers leave. They go to the cities to find jobs. And so it's having a major impact on the structure of rural communities.
Oh, yeah.
And the big farms keep growing, and they have all the advantage. They have price advantage, and they have clout in the marketplace, and they're very good at what they do. They're well managed. These people are smart, and they have a lot of money to deal with, and they don't know how to handle it. What they can't handle is their debt. They're really they're limited on what they can borrow. They're at the limits in many cases. And this, but the farm consolidation keeps going on, and the pressure is going to come from financing. When it comes, it'll hit them hard. But up until that time, they're a real threat to the future of small scale farming in rural communities in general.
Right. This hasn't reached to the depth that that it needs to, of course. But I think another way to that is leading to this demise is the fact that there is a growing consumer demand for sustainably grown and organic foods.
There is.
And much of that, not all of that, that's in a big debate, is grown by smaller farms. A lot of the farms out in California that produce a lot of the organics are big farms.
Yes, they are.
Getting around.
Yeah, the size doesn't matter.
Yeah.
No, as far as I'm concerned. It's what they're doing with it.
Right, right. So that's another thing that this whole sustainable ag movement may be contributing to ultimately, and having some structure if the right laws can get put in and support the people that are moving in that direction. And
yeah.
Continues to be a struggle.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting near the time here, but I wanted to ask you, I didn't talk much about those important 10 years you had after you left the Carter administration to work with the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And as I mentioned, we were talking before how important that organization was even to my own family and the my grandparents' farm, the one my mom grew on, how much difference it made when that cooperative came through and they finally had electricity on their farm. What did you basically do there?
Well, the REA was a New Deal program. It started with Franklin Roosevelt, started the thing in the early 30s, and it was an idea that caught fire quickly and started in the South primarily, but it kept growing and it came up here in the Middle West. And by the late 30s, it was going almost everywhere.
Yeah.
People were agitated to start find a way to form an electric cooperative. Federal government created an agency called the Rural Electrification Administration. They provided the engineering support. They provided the know-how and how to build and run and manage and maintain a rural utility company.
Yeah.
Were hugely important. And financing to go with it. So that thing really took off.
Mm-hmm. And what were you able, by the time it was in the 80s, what were you doing, just trying to maintain these?
Or well, maintain it, of course. There was the power industry by that time had given up trying to kill it. They saw they couldn't kill it, so they do what they could to kind of irritate everything. But
yeah.
We kept the thing going, and the REA, that is, and it's to this day. Its role is diminished because there isn't, you know, these have been a lot of consolidation in the utility business.
Yeah.
Not the REA cooperatives merged with one another, formed larger cooperatives and farmed utilities of their own, but they're still locally owned. Mm-hmm. But so there aren't very many independent local REAs anymore. They're a part of some kind of a larger organization to deal with the power supply and transmission questions of their time.
Yeah, I know that's how it is in Minnesota. I think. So,
yeah. Yes, that's the way it is almost all over the country.
Ah, I see. And I imagine they're doing things like, I would think with like one of the issues that's sort of similar to the REA and the New Deal was getting the internet out there in a good way. To
that's right. That came after my time.
Oh, yeah. But I would think they're part of that whole
thing. Oh, they are. Yeah. It's the same. It's the same energy. But it's generated by young people,
right?
Not people my age.
Yeah,
I'm from the mechanical generation. I don't understand even the jargon that my grandchildren use today. I don't know what they're talking about, and they don't know what I'm talking about. So we gotta cross paths there.
Right. Well, you got to keep talking to each other.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
From you.
Yeah.
And then you finished up with your formal service, then were invited to become a regent.
Yes, I was. Yes. A regent's spot opened up. A man retired, and I had a couple friends on the Board of Regents that and some members of the legislature came to me and said, I should apply for that job. They'd like to see me on there. So I said, well, I don't know how to go about this. And well, we'll help you. So I said, okay, let's go. So I did. I became a candidate and went through the tests and and talked to the people I had to talk to and introduced myself and got acquainted, and I was elected. That was a job I enjoyed immensely.
Did you?
Yeah, oh, I sure did.
Yeah, it was, and you did that, well, it's a six-year term.
Six-year term, yeah.
Yeah. I know that, I think about that, you know, you came to the university having never even been to Minneapolis before in 1946, and now come back full circle to be the region.
It's that's
a
right. Nice way to, I was vice chairman of the board, and it got to the point where I had to decide if I was going to stay, they were going to make me chairman of the Board of Regents. And I didn't think I could do it. Uh-huh. I was getting along in years.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really up. I didn't think I had the credentials for that job. So I did not run and seek re-election. I retired entirely and went home.
Yeah.
I was 65 years old by that time. Time to slow down.
Yeah. And you still had a hand in, your family still owns the farm.
We still own the farm. Well, I sold it to the kids, but
we don't
farm it now.
So you get your kids farming it?
Yeah, they're farming it. Yep. Good. They take care of it.
And then you and your wife, Helen, have a place in town.
Well, no, we have a home on the farm.
Oh, do you?
But we're right by town. Or,
oh, I see.
We had, part of our farm is now incorporated in the city limits.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, we had land that was right adjacent to this city-owned golf course. It had nine-hole golf course.
Oh, yeah.
On the south side of town, along the river. And our farm was just south of that, adjacent to it.
I see.
And the mayor of the town was a good friend of mine. He said, we're in a terrible fix here. We've got our golfers in town want us to expand to an 18-hole golf course. The golfers in town were a number at that time, business people and others, and said, we've looked everywhere for land, and they looked across the river from where we lived in the woods there, and said it's just too expensive to try to open that land up for a golf course. And would there's any way we could buy some land from you? I said, no, but I tell you what we'll do, we'll trade. Well, what do you have in mind? I said, I'll trade this 80 acres of land to the city. You could take it for the golf course, in return for which I want you to incorporate that entire quarter section in the city limits, take over the water and sewer and streets.
Oh.
So they did.
Huh.
So now it's a part of the village of Roseau, and they run the streets and the utilities there, and the golf course has been developed. We have an 18-hole golf course.
How big a town is Roseau about?
About 2,000 people.
Yeah.
Small community.
Yeah, yeah.
But the stipulation I had was that I wanted to be sure that the kids get a chance to play. I said, I want golf course policies to be that kids will be encouraged to play golf and they come there and play and enjoy themselves, but behave themselves, of course. You have to, no roughhousing.
Yeah.
But I don't want any charge placed on them. Yeah. And so they agreed to that, and it's that policy to this day.
Good.
Little kids out there, 12, 13 years old, dragging their little bag around, learning how to play.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, then the last thing I want, if you don't mind, would be going back a little bit on the farm policy front. If you were now, you know, back in the situation where you were in 1977 and were looking like forward for what policies really need to change, or what, you know, what needs to be done, do you think? What course directions going forward? With this, we have a farm bill coming up in 2018. A lot of people are starting to think about it already. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Not really. I've become rather discouraged. The farming organizations are falling apart. They can't agree with each other on anything, really. There's no consensus on any kind of a change in agricultural policy. The administration's no help. And we're just sort of floundering. Something is going to evolve and essentially gel, but right now it's not happening.
I think you're right. The thing where we're hoping that one of the things that can grow because of the fact that it's got more and more economics behind it is this move towards the more sustainable and organic food production, and that a lot of the effort of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition going forward is in that area, trying to strengthen more research dollars going to these farmers that are trying these methods and things like that.
I think
it'll be incremental.
It will be, but it'll be steady.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people had believed that this campaign we're on, farming with all the techniques and the modern society provides, based on on non-renewable resources is coming to an end.
Yeah.
Things got to change.
Mm-hmm.
People know that, but they don't quite know how to do it. But so it's going to happen. It's going to be a generational thing. People my age, I'm 85, 88 years old, and I'm out of it now. And my kids are in their 70s, and they're going to be out of it. But my grandchildren are coming.
Yep.
They're going to universities. They're getting educated in all these exotic sciences and all the new things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming home as college students and talk to me about things I never heard of, that are becoming standard jargon in their community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to happen. These kids are going to take over the government, the universities and the colleges and the legislatures and run things much better than my generation could run it. I'm very encouraged by what I hear among young people. They call them millennials, and I say more power to them.
Good. Well, that's a perfect way to end this. And I hope that those millennials also listen to what
I hope
you
so.
Have to say and what you've learned along the way.
I hope
many
so.
Valuable lessons.
I'm Bless them. Up. Bless them.
Thank you very much.
This has been part of the National Sustainable Agriculture Oral History Archive, produced by Ron Cruz, available on the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture website. The podcast was made possible by the Center for Rural Affairs.